Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
Cancer and Nutrition. Welcome to Volume 85 in the Brecan What's On Information Sessions, a series of talks produced for people with gynecological or breast cancer, their families and friends. This session was recorded on the 25th of February 2013 at the offices of Women's Health Victoria, located in Melbourne's CBD. Jo White is an experienced clinical dietitian working in oncology at Cabrini Hospital. She has a strong focus on helping people make real-life choices about their food and nutrition. And in this session, she discusses some of the common issues people have about their nutrition following a cancer diagnosis. And we hope that you enjoy this session.
Alright, so these are the things I'd like to cover off today, and everybody has got a handout which has a copy of all of the slides, or most of the slides. Some of the pictures didn't turn out so well in print form, so we've omitted them. But if you've got a question as we're going through, just jot it down next to the pertaining slide, and then we can always go back to it and talk about that later. So we're going to look a little bit at diet and cancer, the healthy eating guidelines, a little bit about alcohol, activity, phytoestrogens, because they always seem to pop up as something that people are interested in talking about, antioxidants, the omega-3 fats, dairy, and alternative or complementary diets. So firstly, the guidelines for cancer survivors, and this is from the Cancer Council, their position statement, you can find it on the website there. They pretty much want us all to maintain a healthy body weight, which is really for everybody. It's not just for a cancer survivor or someone going through cancer management and treatment. Physical activity, which we've all heard and some of us groan at, that we have to do that every day, 30 minutes roughly. So at least it's not running a marathon. That's one good thing. Eating more vegetables and fruit, limiting alcohol, and food safety. So handling and preparing food safely, and that's something I'll touch on a little bit later, because that's one that often gets a little bit overlooked, is about purchasing and then storing and preparing food as far as health goes. Now let's get cracking into it. So hunger probably is one of the things that people often find a little bit challenging, perhaps when they're going through treatment, the effects of some of the drugs that you've gone through or might still be taking. So is that a common thing that people have found? Yeah. Appetite changes. It either goes through the roof or it's through your boots. You've either got a great appetite and you want to eat everything in sight, or you don't want to touch food. The taste changes as well. Was that experienced by most people? Yeah. All of a sudden, pick up the cup of coffee and it just doesn't taste right. And you've been an addict for years and now all of a sudden it doesn't taste good. And that's a very common problem with going through some of the treatments, is that your taste perception and your appetite change, and therefore your oral intake is going to be affected, and you're left with a limited group of foods that you can even tolerate. And then how do we get around that and make you nutritionally sound with this limited intake? And sometimes those taste changes and perception of foods and what you want to eat can last after you've had treatment. So even though all the mouth ulcers or anything like that may have gone and everything's fine again, you still have this inbuilt thing that I can't eat that food. And that's a challenge. So with hunger, we look at what is real physical hunger? And are we actually responding to physical hunger, or are we responding to things like it's 1 o'clock, it's lunchtime? Or emotional hunger? Guilty. Very guilty. Especially if there's a lint ball involved and a bit of a not so great day. So, and environmental hunger, meaning such as say something today where would you normally have eaten biscuits or something like that for morning tea, but you'll have one because they're here. And that's not a bad thing. It's just being aware that that's something that we do. There is a terrific book that I often recommend to people by a man named Rick Krausman. And the book is called If Not Dieting, Then What? As if we are all so programmed to be on a diet. And diet is a four-letter word. Now, it's a bad one. But it really just means, what food are you eating? That's all diet is. But his book is about, well, if we're not on a diet, then what happens? If you say to yourself, I don't need to actually be on a diet, what am I going to do? And one of the things that he says in his book is, I can have it, but do I really want it? And that's something that's good to keep in your mind when you're looking at perhaps foods that might be more of the treat foods, is a case of, I can have that, but do I really want it? So we'll go into that a little bit more further down the track. Fullness is another thing that I think sometimes we get a little bit mistaken with too, regarding nutrition and food, and how much are we eating? So you hear a lot about, you know, how do I lose weight, or how do I manage my weight? And a lot of that comes down to, well, what are you eating? And then we go also into what sort of things are we eating. So we'll touch on that one a little bit further down the track. So we look at the types of foods that we're having and the exercise that we're doing. Lean and clean fuel. Does everyone know what I mean by lean and clean? Pretty much low fat and clean food, meaning it hasn't been hampered and touched too much by processing. So if it is as it was meant to be, if it grows, eat it. If it doesn't grow, don't eat it. But if it's a food that has come, you know, and hasn't been interfered with as much as processing goes, that's really what we should be looking at as far as healthiness goes with what we're eating. But also, particularly for someone who's survived cancer, because we just don't want anything unnatural going in there as far as the chemicals and the processing goes. So if we keep it as lean, meaning low fat, and that's for most people. Some people, we do need to crank the fats up a little bit because they might have issues with trying to gain weight and maintain weight. But lean and clean is generally a little catchphrase that I like to use. Regular smaller meals and snacks. Now, who's been guilty of having breakfast and then getting to about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and thinking, I'm feeling a bit hungry, got a headache, feeling a bit vague, realising you haven't eaten anything. Guilty? Yeah, everyone. So keeping everything going, having smaller amounts of food more often is how we're designed to function. And that's something that really is a major change if you can do that, having regular main meals and small snacks. But it comes down to how big are those meals as well. Now remember your little fire. Now I like to say that your metabolism, which is the rate or the speed at which your body uses fuel, your metabolism is like a little fire. So if everyone's been camping at some stage in their life or had to light a fire, small amounts of kindling, often, that's how you get it burning and burning. If you starve a fire, it goes out. And if you walk up and you smother it with a big log, it will also go out. So our bodies are not designed to have big periods of time without food, nor are we designed to have huge, you know, gorging meals where it's just too much in one go. So that's what I mean by remember your metabolism. Small amounts of fuel. And that's not even in regards to weight loss or weight management, it's just always. We can't deal with too much food in one go, and our bodies are not designed that way. We are actually still cave people, or cavemen, women. So our physiology and our anatomy really hasn't changed for thousands and thousands of years. We're the same on the inside. What's changed is what's out there. So Baker's Delight, processed foods, you know, things that we can purchase that are already packaged. And we're not really designed to digest those foods. So if you think of your body still as being quite ancient, and think about what did the ancient people eat, that's what I'm trying to put forward to you, that the more natural the foods are, the better it is, and your body does better with those foods. And being organised and planning your intake. Plastic containers are your friend, or glass if you prefer. but I'm not allowed to say the you know, the ones that start. So taking things with you, being prepared, then you don't have to say to yourself, I have to eat something that's, you know, not perhaps what I really want to do, and it doesn't take that much effort to put something into a container and take it with you. So just being organised can be a really big bonus as far as your health and nourishment goes. One of the things that people often talk to me about, and particularly with some of the more gynecological cancers, is weight gain during treatment or after treatment. And a lot of the time it can be blamed, if you like, on being just so fatigued through your treatment and all of the appointments and sitting there for hours and doing all of that sort of thing, and then just feeling pretty worn out after you've had treatment as well. And that's often a problem then, being not able to keep up with your activity level. Menopausal, being thrown into an early menopause perhaps, or if you've already had the menopause and then you've also got problems on top of that with some of the treatments and those hormonal changes. Am I getting a few people relating to that one?
Yeah.
Yes. The cancer treatments sometimes, the steroids, the prednisolone, the dexamethasone, yeah? That's a nasty one for putting weight on, but in two senses. The steroid drugs are great because they help you manage the treatment that you're going through, the chemotherapy or the radiotherapy. But they increase your appetite like no end.
Yes.
Yeah, we've experienced that. And they make you want sugar a lot of the time, carbohydrates, starchy food. All of a sudden you want coffee scrolls and things that you've not previously been, you know, craving for. Or salt. Did anyone have salt cravings with Dexa? Yeah? Hot chips?
Oh, yeah.
Wow, yeah. There we go.
And sauce.
Hot chips and sauce, yeah. Dexa does that to you. So quite often, those drugs, they not only increase your appetite, but they increase your appetite for foods that perhaps aren't as the better choices, maybe. But they do affect your metabolism. So it's not just the food, because it's not the fact that, you know, some people do have DEXA and prednisolone and they're not affected in that way, but they can also make you retain fluids. And so therefore you can be walking around with quite a few extra kilos on you, and a lot of it's fluid weight as well. So changes in food intake, I mentioned earlier about taste changes and perception, appetite changes, whereby you think the only thing that I can eat today is, you know, toasted cheese sandwiches, and that might go for 3 days in a row. And then you just think vegetables, fruit, those sorts of things just aren't doing it for you. So that can be a problem too, particularly. You reduce metabolic rate because you're not as active, and also you've been affected by the drugs as well, and retention of fluid. So you've got a few things that are working against us as far as weight management goes, with going through treatment, but then also on the other end. And that's not just, I'm not only focusing on weight gain, because for some people it is the other way. They find it very difficult to maintain weight. They can't put the weight on, they lose it, and then it's really hard because their appetite is gone. So we can talk a little bit about that too. So how do I lose weight? This one irritates me. Don't know if it irritates you as well. Just eat less. We hear that all the time, don't we? Eat less and do more. And that one just, it is to a point. It's true. It's calories in versus calories out. And that's really what does manage our weight. But when you've got a list of other things that are working against you and situations that's really not optimal, then this one can be a little bit challenging. But I do want you to just keep it in mind that it is true, sadly, but we'll be a bit kind to ourselves because of some of the situations that people find themselves in. I particularly like this cartoon. I'm prescribing a low-carbohydrate diet for your diabetes, a high-carb diet for your colon, a low-fat diet for your heart, and a high-fat diet for your nerves. It just looks like, you know, something off a woman's weekly each week, doesn't it? There's a new diet out every 5 minutes which tells us that this is what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing, and it is really hard to follow what should I be doing. There's so much information out there, and what's right and what's wrong. Now just think about it too for a moment. Upon diagnosis, or even through your journey, I'm sure people wanted to share their stories with you, or share the stories of their cousin or their friend or someone down the track, and this great diet that they did, or this great thing that they tried and it worked. And that then just makes it even more confusing for you because you've got all this bombardment of information. But what I want you to look at is particularly with priorities, when you're looking at how should I eat, what should I be eating? Does the eating plan that you're looking at following, does it offer a wide variety of food? Or is it limiting? Is there a major food group that's being left out? Or are you being encouraged to not have it at all? That's something that concerns me particularly. Is it a plan that you can live with for a very long time? Can you do this for the rest of your life? Or is it something where it's just do it for 6 weeks? And then I'd be thinking, well, what are we changing there? Why is it only for a short period of time? Do you still enjoy eating? If you have to follow this plan, is food still okay and fun and interesting and enjoyable? Or is it becoming a bit of a chore? Make sure that there are fruits and vegetables and cereals and low-fat foods in that diet. If those things are being omitted, then that's a real concern. And looking at weight management, I'd look at 0.5 kilo a week, really. Maybe 1 kilo if you were really, really gunning it. But 0.5 kilo is pretty much, you've got to think, 0.5 kilo of fat loss is a big tub of margarine. That's pretty big. Mm-hmm. You know when you stand on the scales and you think, I've only lost 400 grams, I've only lost 0.5 kilo. That's that big margarine container full of pure fat. That's what I want you to think about. So don't be discouraged by the fact that if you have stood on the scales, if you've been trying to lose weight, that you think, oh, it's only a few hundred grams, okay? All right, so we're just touching again on metabolism. It is the rate at which your body uses up energy. Remember the little fire, small amounts often. And I just want to mention starvation mode, because I mentioned to you before about going long periods of time without food. Our bodies are designed, as I said before, as caveman, cavewoman, we're designed to avoid exactly that starvation mode. When you go long periods of time without food, your body starts to shut down a little bit and it says, right, I'm going to hold on to absolutely everything that you give me now. So it says she's been starving me for 8 hours, 9 hours maybe, and this has been a bit of a pattern. I'm going to hold everything that she gives me. And then what does your body do with fuel that it holds on to? It stores it. Stores it away for later, just in case you do it again. So please stop with the, if anyone's guilty, long periods of time without food is not a good way to go. We need small amounts often to keep fueling so that we avoid that starvation mode. Does everyone remember the old pyramid that used to, the food pyramid that used to be on the back of cereal packets and etc.? And a lot of them at the time, it's still there. The Dietitians Association and the National Dietary Guidelines people got together and they've changed it now. So now we've got this lovely plate. And it's the same thing, it's just represented as a plate instead. Now you haven't got a picture of it in your notes because it didn't show up well when we printed it. But you can find this one on the website that I've given at the end of the talk. So pretty much it's the same as the pyramid. The reason they got rid of the pyramid was because people always thought that the things at the top were the best, you know, the fairy on the Christmas tree, and yet that was where all the fat and the sugar and the junk was. So it was being misunderstood. So they've put it down now mostly as a plate. So saying that really a good variety of grains and cereals, fruits and veggies, dairy, bit of meat, and you might even see that the treats way off down in the right hand corner, they're not even considered part of the daily plate intake. Okay, carbohydrates, the starchy foods, their role is pretty much to put glucose or sugar into your bloodstream. That's your main source of fuel. That's the fuel that your brain works on and the fuel that most of the body works on. If you've got extra, once you've filled up your blood glucose levels or your blood sugar levels, your body will store it as something called glycogen, and that gets stored in the muscles and in the liver. So that if you do have a period of time where you're not taking in any carbohydrate and you need some blood, some sugar in your blood, the body will then draw from those stores to top up the blood. So it's a little bit of robbing Peter to pay Paul, and that's how it keeps it balanced. The role of the carbohydrates is to keep your metabolism going. your central nervous system, so all of your brain functions. It means that you're using it as your primary source of fuel and you're sparing protein. Now, protein is your muscle mass, pretty much. So if we've got carbohydrate in your system, you're using that as fuel and you're not breaking down your muscle mass. And we've got some good dietary sources there of carbohydrates, usual things, bread, pastas, rice, fruit, veggies, dairy foods, and legumes, etc. Good old starchy foods. Now, we used to talk about carbohydrates as being simple versus complex. Does that sound familiar to some people? Yeah. And that's slightly outdated now. We tend to talk about the glycemic index, another new catchphrase. Again, is that familiar to some people? Yeah. So the glycemic index is simply a ranking system of how quickly does your body use that carbohydrate and how quickly does it turn into glucose or sugar and go into your bloodstream. So I'll use the example of something like white bread versus a really grainy, gutsy, grainy bread. So the white bread would be digested and broken down to glucose quite quickly in the digestive system, released into your blood system as sugar, probably around 20 minutes. Whereas a really nice, thick, gutsy, you know, grainy bread, that could take up to an hour. So we tend to look then, is it a high glycemic index food or is it low glycemic index food? And a good way to remember it is slow. Low GI means slow release. It's a bit of a trickle of sugar or glucose into your system. A bit like putting your thumb over the hose and letting it trickle down as opposed to a big spurt. Now, is anyone going to do a little activity and be a volunteer? You are required to eat a lolly. Anyone brave?
Yeah.
Yeah? Come on. I'm going to show you just a very quick demonstration on how quickly our bodies respond to nutrition, particularly sugar. Very exciting. Do you know what? The good thing is I'm going to hand these around so you all get one as well. Not just those special. All right, come over here. Right, over there. Will that still be able to hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. What I'm going to do with...
Ultra.
Ultra, easy. All right. I'm going to ask you to put your arms out. And all I'm going to do is push down, no, not too hard, on her arms, and she's going to push up against me. Ready, set. Oh, she's quite strong. Wow. Oh. Okay, maybe I should have picked someone up. Now, what I want you to do after is have a lolly and chew it up and let it go all around your mouth so there's lots of absorption. We actually start to absorb carbohydrate and glucose first thing in our... This is the beginning of our digestive system. Often we think it's all happening down here, but in fact it's all starting here. So the more you can swoosh it around, lots of saliva, getting it all sucking in. Is that feeling pretty nice? They're good, aren't they? Yeah. My favourite thing. What do you
reckon? Have you swallowed it? It's gone. Arms out.
I'm going to do this again. Now, in your head, I want you to think, what's probably going to happen to her? Ready, set, go.
Oh.
So
you're pushing harder.
I think so, don't you? All right, I'm going to let you stay there for 30 seconds, maybe. So it seems that it was harder.
Mm-hmm.
I swear I was pushing exactly the same. Right, let's try again. Now. Oh, good. You're back to normal. Maybe even a little stronger. Okay.
I'll have the whole packet.
You can pass them around. If anyone would like one, I'll pass them around. Not many dietitians will let you eat lollies. Now, what that demonstrates, and thank you very much, what that demonstrates is, at first you would think, I've given her fuel. I've given her pure fuel. It's just sugar, glucose. But what happens is, as the body digests that sugar, she was there with her normal blood sugar level circulating in her body. She's ready to do some activity. That's not a problem. She has the sugar. And what happens? We eat sugar. There's another hormone involved called insulin. So when the sugar level comes into the body, the insulin matches it and carries the glucose from the digestive system out into the blood. When that sugar rise is really quick, which it would be with almost pure sugar, sugar goes up, the insulin goes up, and sometimes the insulin overshoots it and brings your blood sugar level down lower than where you started, just for a few moments. That was the reason you felt that it was, you were a bit weaker for that time, and then a few moments later it was all balanced again. So for someone without diabetes, I must point out, that's all going to work well. If you've got diabetes, that's not going to work as well. But what that indicates is that that's how quickly nutrition affects our bodies. And sugar particularly, blood sugar levels, not so much just eating sweets. But if you're going long periods of time, as I said before, without fuel, or you've got very high glycemic index sugars and carbohydrates, the things that release their sugars very quickly, you're going to have a roller coaster of a day, up and down with the blood sugars. And what happens is when those levels go down, we start to feel a bit tired, a bit listless, think, ooh, wouldn't mind a lolly, wouldn't mind a bicky, something to perk you up again. And then you go and have that thing, and we get this again, and half an hour later we're down again. So every couple of hours you're looking for something to perk you up. Whereas if we can put the low glycemic index carbohydrates in, then you're going to get a nice, even, balanced little roll of sugar going into the bloodstream through the day. It's not going to be as dramatic. And then you don't go searching for the things that we shouldn't perhaps be having as much of, but you're going to feel better because you've constantly got this nice trickle of energy into the system. The other thing is that the lower glycemic index carbohydrates tend to be the ones that are better for us anyway. They're higher in grain, higher in fibre, they tend to be less processed. So that's something I just want you to keep in mind. You might need to go and do a bit more research on glycemic index because it is a bit more complex than just that little demonstration, but it gives you a good idea of seeing how quickly sugar can get into your bloodstream. Now, I'm not saying sugar's bad, I'm just saying just be aware of how quickly or slowly those carbohydrates can go into the bloodstream. Now, the things that affect the GI is the type of carbohydrate. So as I said before, whether it's very grainy or not processed or has been processed. The cooking methods that you've used. So if you were to, say, eat an apple, and then that's pretty low GI. If you were to cook it, you're bringing it up to a moderate GI, because by cooking an apple or baking it, you've pretty much partially digested it almost. It's pretty easy then for your body to digest. And then if you were to just drink the juice of the apple, that's going to be a little bit more to the moderate to high level because it's quite a concentrated version of the sugar. Your body didn't have to do much to break it down. And fibre affects the GI, so the higher the fibre, the lower the GI, and fat as well. So that's the one thing that can catch a few people out, is that when they say something like a Mars bar might be low GI, you think, hang on, that's got a whack of sugar in it, but it's also got quite a whack of fat in there. So the fat lowers the GI because it slows digestion. I don't want to fill you up with too much information, but just be aware. All right, so high GI foods are things like honey, cornflakes, baked white potato, wholemeal breads, even white and wholemeal breads, soft drinks, lollies, that sort of thing, sports drinks. Moderate GI is sugar. So don't fear having a sugar in your cup of tea. It's not that bad, but just be aware of how many times you're doing that in a day. White rice, that is, soft drinks, fruit juices, things like Weet-Bix even. Low GI are the things that are, as I said before, less processed. So porridge, multigrain bread, pastas, beans, legumes, fruit, milk, those sorts of things. And when you look at it, they're probably the things we should be eating anyway. They're the better choices. Because it's still pretty processed. It's because some of the white breads that have high fibre, you know, they advertise them as white high fibre, they've actually got a lower GI because they've added fibre to them than some of the wholemeal breads. So preferably a grainy bread is going to be the one that's better for you. Rice is an interesting one. certain rices have different gradings in GI. So the ones that we say are the lower GI rices are basmati and dungara. Dungara is an Australian grown rice. The long grain rices, it has to do with the starch and how tightly knit those starch particles are, and therefore how much work does it take to digest to break them down and release the sugars. So the dungara and basmati have a sort of tighter knit, if you like, form of starch, whereas the white rices, they're a little bit looser, so it doesn't take as much for the body to break it down and release the glucose into the system. Yeah.
Do you guys use
fresh
pastas, low GI?
Yeah, fresh pasta is even the better one. Better again.
Better than brown, than
dried out stuff.
No, the whole, sorry, I've lost the word. The wholemeal pasta?
About the same. Oh. Yeah, about the same. But as I said, there's a great website that if you, in fact, use a search engine of choice and search GI, there is a website and they've got everything listed on there that you can have a good look at. So looking at the dietary guidelines, the breads and cereals, we really want you to choose whole grain ones. And this is just really from a health point of view. Different types of breads and cereals, you can mix it around a little bit. Two to four serves a day. Now the dietary guidelines used to say up to 11 serves a day, which we all used to jump up and down and say that's ridiculous unless you're about 16 years old and male and playing football 10 times a week. Especially when you look at one serve of carbohydrate or of the breads and cereals is the equivalent of two slices of bread. So technically that's eight slices of bread. So really this needs to be interpreted as to what are your energy needs, how much activity are you doing in the day, and what do you actually, that's where you might sit down with a dietitian and work out what am I doing and what do I really need. A good source of insoluble fibre. Now, the two types of fibre, soluble, insoluble. Soluble is the one that we can digest and your body uses, and that helps with bowel health. The insoluble is what we used to call roughage. That's pretty much the stuff that comes out. So we don't use it so much, but most of the breads and cereals that we have these days have been processed in a way that it's a good form of insoluble fibre. So just keep a little look there at the serving sizes. So a half to one cup of breakfast cereal is a serve. Now, as a little exercise, when you go home, measure it out. How much is half a cup of cereal? It's really not that much. And when you think about what we do in the morning, perhaps pouring out our cereals, just it's a good indicator of serving sizes as to what you're doing and how much you're having. And again, half to one cup of cooked rice or noodles or pasta is one serve. And again, I know that that's a pretty meagre serve when you look at it, when you think about what we would normally put on a plate, perhaps. So the dietary guidelines again, eating more vegetables and fruit, five serves of vegetables a day, two serves of fruit. A variety is really important. When I teach children, and I'm actually using it a lot more now with adults as well, but I say, eat a rainbow every day. So there's no one wonder vegetable. There's no magic, you know, king of the crop. We need to have a variety of vegetables to get all the different minerals and vitamins from all those different colours. The different colours have different levels of vitamins and minerals in them. Likewise, I don't want you to just be eating, you know, the same three vegetables every day, because then you're missing out on all the other things, but you're also getting a bit, you know, just always the same thing. All right, so a rainbow, lots of different colours, lots of different varieties is really important. And it's not that hard to fit them in, especially when you think that it's only half a cup is one serve. So I don't need you to be eating two, you know, big buckets of vegetables or anything, but you do need to look at the variety. Now, protein is probably one of my little favourite things, especially for people who have gone through cancer, recovering, going through treatment, and out the other end, anywhere in between. A lot of the therapies that we have to go through for treating cancers tend to, obviously, kill off the nasty cells, but they tend to kill off a lot of healthy cells as well. And it's mostly the cells that line the gut that that are affected by chemotherapy and radiotherapy. So that the gut starts in your mouth. So that's why perhaps mouth ulcers, taste changes, all of those things are happening, but the lining of your mouth is being affected by the chemotherapy, all the way through your digestive system, right down to the bowel. And those cells are being killed off at a quicker rate than what they would normally just be sloughed away. So we need protein, it's the building blocks of new cells. We need to have the protein coming in through your diet so that your body can generate and build new cells back again. Otherwise, what happens? We start to break down our muscle mass to try and provide the protein to the body to grow new cells to recover. And that's where frailness comes in, which is a dirty word, frailness. We don't like frail. Right? We want strong, healthy women, not women who are losing muscle mass. So that's why I want you to really focus on protein. The role in the body is pretty much for body structures. So muscles, hormones, your immune system really requires quite a bit of protein. And your gut is very much involved in your immune system. So if the gut and the lining of the gut is at all compromised, it brings your immune system down. You become more susceptible to bugs and illnesses. And it's just needed for general health as well. So dietary sources tend to be the animal products. So meat, fish, chicken, eggs, dairy products, soy, and some of the protein alternatives now that are around, which mostly tend to be plant-based. So I think one of the more popular ones at the moment now is something that's called corn, but it's spelled Q-U-O-R-N. Has anyone seen that or used it?
Yeah,
interesting flavour.
I think it's processed.
It is. Again, it's a processed food. So if you can stick with the more natural, then that's probably a better way to go.
What's that, nuts?
Nuts is a really good one. Mostly, they're fat. So the predominant composition of nuts is fat. But they do have a bit of protein and they do have a lot of fibre. So they're actually a very good snack in small amounts. So we don't want to be sitting and eating too many. But as a source of protein, especially if you were to be adding nuts into something like a cereal mix or a trail mix that you have a small handful of with some dried fruits and things like that during the day, they're a good little snack. Usually it's around 30 grams, which if you think about filling up a matchbox with almonds or hazelnuts or some such, that's about 30 grams. Just to give you a little visual idea of it. It's not a lot, unfortunately. A lot less than what we would like to maybe have each day, but it gives you a little bit of an idea.
Isn't that Q-U-I-N? Is that related or the same as quinoa?
No, different. Yeah, so quinoa is a different grain. It does have an amount of protein in it, but the quinoa is another ancient grain that's become quite popular too because it's gluten-free. Yeah, fine. Again, interesting flavour, so it might be something you enjoy, it might be something you
can make
have.
Yummy salads.
Yeah, it's a bit like, similar to couscous, and different things.
But it hasn't got the carbohydrate.
Not as high a carbohydrate level, that's right, and it is generally a low GI. All right, milk and yogurt and cheese. Do you remember the old ad that used to be on telly? Piece of cheese, a glass of milk, that one tub of yogurt. Well, that's pretty much right. So we're looking at 3 serves a day. The main thing that we get from our dairy food is calcium and, in some cases, too, vitamin D. So calcium is really important. A lot of the drugs that perhaps we would have gone on, again, the steroid drugs, they tend to leach calcium from your bones. And a lot of some of the pain medication as well can be leaching of calcium. So we really do need to stock it up. Now, a lot of the time people think, is it too late? Am I, too old to be topping ourselves up? There's never a limit, all right? So I want you to think of it like a little bank account and keep putting that calcium in each day, preferably with real food. But sometimes, depending on what treatments you've gone through, you might need to be taking a supplement. So that's something to talk with your doctor and possibly if you've got a dietitian as well, that's really important to do. But I'm just saying, real food first, but sometimes we do need to take a supplement to go with it. Similarly with vitamin D. Now, I'm guilty, I had low vitamin D, I'm sure. Yeah, there's quite a few nodding heads, yeah. And again, that's a treatment thing as well. Sometimes too, we can blame it on the fact that we've been so diligent with our flip, flop, flap. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been very, very careful, and you know, I've walked in today wearing my hat and being very cautious of the sun. So in some ways, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. But we do need to be aware of it. Low vitamin D levels and low calcium levels can really affect your bone health, and especially after treatment, you're just already a little bit behind the eight ball. So I want you to be careful there.
So what happens if, like, I'm lactose intolerant?
So yeah. So what about a lactose-free milk?
Oh, no.
No?
Don't just like the word comes enough
too. Oh, okay. You've not tried lactose-free?
I have not.
Okay.
Just
because it doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a dirty word.
So there are with a lot of the soy milk options, they fortify those with extra calcium and vitamin D. They're quite adequate. Not a problem.
Mm.
If you're looking at things like almond milk, rice milk, those sorts of things, the calcium level's usually not there because they're not as popular and mainstream. Yeah. They haven't supplemented them as much.
Mm.
So then I'd be looking at other options for vitamin D, which might come from some of the oily fishes and fats and things, which would be something you could research a little more. And then again, we'd look at supplementation down the track.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. All right, meat, chicken, fish, the usual. These are our sources of protein. So if it is an animal or if it came from an animal, it's going to be high in protein generally. 1 to 2 serves a day. Now, a serve of meat is about the size of a deck of cards, and that's around about 100 grams. So the palm of your hand, perhaps, or think of the deck of cards, that's about the serving size that we need. And cooked fish, again, it might be a little bit bigger. Remember that when you cook fish, it loses a lot of water. So what you buy is not really what you get to eat at the end. So just think, buy bigger, and then by the time it's cooked, because it does have a high water content. Red meat, we like it to be up to 3 or 4 times a week. That's not always achievable, but if you can aim for it, then you might at least get 2 or 3 meals in of red meat. Fish, 2 to 3 times a week, and I prefer the deep sea fish. Reason being is that they're higher in the omega-3 oils. Because they live in colder water, they've got more of a fat content in their own flesh, so you're getting more bang for your buck, pretty much. You're getting the omega-3s in there as well. There doesn't appear to be a strong association between red meat and cancer risk. Now, around about the 80s, I think it was, there was a campaign, you know, red meat causes cancer. And when that was looked into and pulled apart a little bit by a lot of the dietitians looking at it at the time, it was a very clever campaign because it stopped people from eating red meat. But in fact, and it was mostly in regards to bowel cancer. Now, the problem with that was, in fact, the red meat was not the culprit. But a diet that's very high in red meat is often not inclusive of the fruits and the vegetables and the grains. So there's a big piece of meat on the plate and maybe a bit of a cooked potato or something and not much else. So in fact, the causational relationship was more that the diet was low in fibre, had a higher causal risk to bowel cancer than eating the red meat alone. So being careful of some of the messages that you might hear about certain foods and certain nutrients, don't just take them on face value. You really need to think, all right, who provided the information? Where did the research come from? That sort of thing. And really have a good think about, you know, what might the real message be in there.
What about the red meat versus cholesterol? 3 to 4 times?
Lean meat, I should say, in there. So the main part, or the problem with cholesterol relationship, is saturated or animal fat. So lean meat, the muscle part, if you can see the fat, you cut it off. Or the skin on the chicken, you take that off. I know, I'm sorry, it's the nicest bit for some people, but as far as cholesterol goes, that's what we need to do. The benefits of the meat and the meat protein is very important to us. But if you can cut the meat fat off and not cook with it, then that's going to counteract the risk then of cholesterol as well.
Can I miss something then? The fish on the deep sea fish, that was salmon. You're saying remove that?
Oh, no. Skin of chicken. Take that off. Yeah, no, leave the skin of fish, that's fine. No, that doesn't have anywhere of a problem with cholesterol. No, that's fine, you can eat that bit. And that's usually the really nice crispy bit on the outside anyway. That's the bit we want. So limiting the processed meats, you know, the sausages and the frankfurts and all of those things that you might be a bit suspicious about what's actually ended up in the sausage at the end, those are the things we want to get rid of out of the diet, or have them only occasionally. They're usually high fat and high salt, and really nourishing. As far as nourishment goes, they're not that great. I'm just cautious of time, so I want to keep moving along a little. The role of fat is really important in our bodies, and I don't want anyone to think that we can't have fat. You know, fat's often also a bad word that we think, oh no, we must have none at all. We need it very much for a lot of the production of our cells and our hormones and various functions in the body. But we do want to not have a storage of excess fat in the system. Now there's three types of fat. There's the saturated, monounsaturated, polyunsaturated. Now they can be split into two groups. Saturated comes from animals and mono and polys come from plants. And for the most part, we want to focus on the monos and the polys. They're the vegetable oils and vegetable fats. And they tend to be what we call the good fats. So you see the good and the bad. The animal fats tend to be the ones that we want to try and avoid. So fats, well, we all know where they are. They're pretty much in the obvious things like butters and oils and margarines, but they can be hidden. So what I want you to start also thinking about, and I'm sure you guys do already, is reading labels and having a look at what things appear as. They don't always just say fat. They'll say all sorts of other names for it along the way. So just being a little bit of a sleuth as far as reading labels go. And that goes also on label reading for things like salt and sugar. There's about 20 different ways of saying sugar. You know, monosaccharides, disaccharides, you know, syrups, invert syrups, rice syrups, this sort of thing. It's all sugar. So you need to be quite careful. When, a little bit off track here, but with labelling, most ingredients are listed from most to least. So if you read that it's got, you know, flour, eggs, they're the things that are in most abundance. And then down toward the end might be the flavours and colourings and, you know, spices and things like that. If sugar, fat, are in the very first two or three, then you know that that's the most abundant ingredient in that food. Now, to get around some of the labelling laws where they say you can only have a percentage of sugar in something, depending on how it's been labelled, then they might say, well, yes, here's our cane sugar component, but there's also a rice syrup that's been added, or an invert syrup or something rather else that's been added, so that really there's still a hell of a lot of sugar in there, but it's just been labelled in a tricky way so they get around it. So just being careful, reading labels is really good. The fewer numbers the better, is as far as I'm concerned. When you're reading a label, if you can see real foods in something, that's great. But if there's lots of things in brackets and numbers and funny names, we might try to get away from those.
Is there a recommended percentage with fat, with saturated fat, that you should aim to
be? Yeah. The Heart Foundation have got some really good guidelines. So if you get a chance to get onto their website, that's a really good one. But generally we say for a low-fat diet, it's around 30 grams a day of fat.
So when you're looking at a tub of yogurt, yep, that gives you a percentage per 100 grams.
Yep.
What percentage should you look at?
I generally look, and if you're looking on labels, at 100 grams. Because when you look at labels, for example, cereal, if you pick up two cereal boxes, the serving size might be 45 grams on one, it might be 60 grams on the other. It's too hard to calculate then, so always go to the 100 grams column, and then looking for a food that's under 10% fat, generally. Yep, that's going to be an overall health, you know, message. If you have specific dietary needs, it might be lower than that, but I'd be encouraging. Just depends. All right, so let's just whiz through here. Fats and oils, we use them sparingly in cooking. Low-fat methods of cooking are great. Trimming the fat, as I said before, from the food that you're having. Just limiting margarine and butter. Looking at alternatives, using a bit of low-fat dip or some chutney or anything else really, just to put some moisture into your sandwich. It doesn't have to be margarine and butter. It could be any other number of relishes or things like that. It really is, that's all butter really does in a sandwich, is just to hold everything together and stick it down and give it a bit of moisture. So if you can think of something that's a little bit less fatty to put in, that's another alternative. Try to limit the amount of high-fat snacks and takeaways and processed foods, fried foods, and using the plant oils mainly as well. There are two oils that are plant-based, which is coconut and palm oil, and they do behave in the body like a saturated fat, so your body can in fact build cholesterol from those. So we do again say it's good to try and limit the intake of palm and coconut oils in your diet.
The local health food man says, told me that coconut oil doesn't change with heat, where some of the other, so if you use a little bit, it's better to use a little bit, because some of the other oils, their composition alters with heat, so.
Yeah, and look, different oils have different heat points at which they start to denature or fall apart and become rancid. One of the common ones is flaxseed oil, which is a really good omega-3, and I think I go into that a little bit further down the track. But that's an oil that can't be heated at all, or else it will denature, so it's got to be kept at room temperature.
So
but yes, you do need to be careful.
So
about
what oil do you choose for cooking, for example?
For me, olive oil is my, yeah, my preference, olive oil. Yeah.
Excuse me, how is the rice oil?
Rice oil is fine too. I just don't know much about the heating point of it. But as far as I know, it can be used in cooking. It has got a significant flavour, so it can affect more the flavours of foods than, say, good old olive oil. Similarly with things like peanut oil or sesame oil, just that remembering they've got a flavour to them already, so they can affect foods. But being a plant-based oil, they're generally quite fine. Okay. Now, extra foods, of course, these are the ones that we all love. But they're the ones that we want to try and limit. So treats basically one or two times a week, and limiting the processed food. It's all common sense. You guys, you know this stuff already. Now water is something that we really harp on about. Mostly we're made of about 90% water, believe it or not. And thirst is really not a good indicator of dehydration. By the time you feel thirsty, you're pretty much already on your way to being a bit dehydrated. I see a few people having a good old sip of water there. That was a good cue. Yeah. So what I want you to do is just hold your hand up in front of you and pinch the skin on the back of your hand. Pull it up a little bit so you make like a little triangle and then let it go. And just see how quickly did it bounce back, or did it kind of hover around for a bit? We've got a few hoverers.
Yeah.
Yeah. A bit dry, maybe. Now, bearing in mind that your collagen and your elastin tend to go a little bit as we get a bit older, so I'll be very careful how I say that. But it's not a bad indicator. So as the better hydration you have, that skin should pop back fairly quickly. If it's really hanging around and kind of taking its time to go back down, it's a bit of an indicator. But by the time you're thirsty, you're already a bit dehydrated. And water, again, similarly to food, we need small amounts often. Guzzling a whole heap of water is sort of like the old saying, putting the cart before the horse. You need to be just taking a good intake of fluids through the day. Now you might find, and I'm sure this has affected some people with treatment, that water tasted funny, metallic even, or a bit tinny, yeah? And people then often would say to me, I don't really want to put sugary cordial into it because that's not good for me either. There has to be a point of compromise. So a little bit of cordial isn't a bad thing if that's what you need to get that fluid in, because really, I'd rather you had a little bit of sugar and were well hydrated than didn't have the fluid because you didn't want to add something to make the taste a bit better. One thing that I've noticed with a few people telling me is that tonic water is very, very well tolerated if you've got that metallic funny taste in your mouth from treatment.
It's good for the ulcers too.
Yeah. Yep. And that was the other thing too, that some of the other drinks would sting if you had ulcers in the mouth or any sort of mucositis. So the tonic water is well tolerated. So just a trick to keep up your sleeve. So generally we look at 8 or 6 to 8 cups a day, being 250 mils being a cup. So we're looking at ideally 2 litres of fluid in a day. Who thinks they'd get 2 litres in?
Is that not
a cup
of the fluid that's in food?
Ah, no. No, that's just it, 2 litres. It's hard. It really is hard to get that much fluid in. But my theory is if you aim for it, you might even get 80%, you know, and that's a really good way of doing it. Coffee doesn't count, right? Because of the caffeine. I know, I'm sorry. Oh, you should see the faces of despair. But because coffee has the caffeine, which is a natural diuretic, so then what happens, you drink one cup of coffee, you'll wee out that cup and another, again, of fluid. So it draws extra fluid with it. So coffee doesn't count. But generally, you know, herbal teas are okay. Tea's okay, but it still does have a wee bit of caffeine in there. But really, just think about keeping a bottle with you all the time, having a glass of water, you know, before lunch or at morning tea, afternoon tea, just that sort of thing along the way. If you commute somewhere, it's easy to drink a small bottle on the way and one again on the way home, and then you've sort of knocked off maybe, you know, 800 mils to a litre in getting there and back. So that's not a bad way either. But we start to feel really ordinary if we get dehydrated. Headache, tired, listless, a bit forgetful, more forgetful than normal. So all those things, achy joints and that sort of thing. So if you're thinking to yourself that you're starting to feel a bit ordinary, then also start to think, when have I drunk well? And did I drink well yesterday? Sometimes there's a bit of a lag time with hydration as well. So you really need to be constantly vigilant about putting that fluid in. It helps with flushing through the medications that you might be on, or any treatments as well, or any subsequent medications that you might be taking. So really help your body by giving it fluid. Most of us can go, you know, if you're having a not so well time, a day or two without eating optimally, that's tolerable. But a day or two without fluids, we're in strife, big strife. So really be vigilant with your water. It's one thing I get on my high horse about. All right, speaking of fluids, alcohol. All right. The Cancer Council recommendations are to limit or avoid alcohol. Not always realistic, but now the standards, or the alcohol recommendations, for men they say no more than 2 standard drinks a day, and for women it's down to 1 standard drink a day. You know, when you go to a hotel or a pub and they pour you a glass of wine and you think, oh, is that all? That's a standard measure, whereas the glass that you might pour yourself at home is a little bit more generous. So we're talking about standard measures, right? And we avoid the binge drinking. Having a few alcohol-free days is part of the recommendation each week. And this is just an example there of what a standard drink is. So a small amount, really. With treatment, often people ask me, can I drink while I'm having chemo? Or can I drink while having radiotherapy? There's no interaction. You can. You can have a glass of wine. You can have a glass of spirits. That's fine. It just might not taste good.
Yeah, you don't feel
like. So again, yep, that funny taste perception thing that happens. You pick up the glass of wine and all of a sudden, you think, oh, that just is awful. It tastes like vinegar or something horrible. So again, it comes down to, if it tastes all right, it's okay to have in moderation as part of the guidelines. If it doesn't taste good, that's fine. Give it a miss for a while. All right, let's get on to physical activity. We all know it's good for us and what it does, so boosting your metabolism and your energy levels, decreasing fatigue. Now, this sounds like a bit of a oxymoron, really, doesn't it? I'm really tired. I should go and go for a walk. But it's true. Going out, using your muscles, it starts to wake everything up. It gets your blood going. The other thing is it gets your head out of the space it was in 10 minutes ago when you were feeling really tired and awful. It doesn't mean running a marathon. It means go just for a walk. Walk down and get the paper and walk back, or just walk around the block. You don't need to set yourself a big, you know, before diagnosis I used to be able to walk, you know, an hour twice a day or something like that. That was then, this is now, and this is I'm going out for a walk for 10 minutes. And if you go for 10 minutes and you think, right, I'm going to keep going for another half hour, great, do that. but it is definitely going to help with fatigue levels. The more active you can be, and small amounts often again, you can do 2 small walks in a day, that's not a problem. That's going to help with fatigue, particularly. It's going to decrease any health risks as well, because you're maintaining your cardiovascular fitness, which can be knocked around quite a bit by treatment. Maintaining the muscle mass, remember I was harping on about that earlier, so keeping those muscles good and strong means that you're going to keep your body physically well and able to get to go through things like having to embark on treatment and getting out the other end. Good for lowering stress and anxiety as well. So guidelines are about 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, and preferably start slowly. So don't go, as my dad would say, like a bull at a gate. Just go slowly. And talk to the doctor about it, talk to your oncologist about it, talk to any health practitioner that's helping you out at the moment, but small amounts. Alright, so these are the things I'd like to cover off today, and everybody has got a handout which has a copy of all of the slides, or most of the slides. Some of the pictures didn't turn out so well in print form, so we've omitted them. But if you've got a question as we're going through, just jot it down next to the pertaining slide, and then we can always go back to it and talk about that later. So we're going to look a little bit at diet and cancer, the healthy eating guidelines, a little bit about alcohol, activity, phytoestrogens, because they always seem to pop up as something that people are interested in talking about, antioxidants, the omega-3 fats, dairy, and alternative or complementary diets. So firstly, the guidelines for cancer survivors, and this is from the Cancer Council, their position statement, you can find it on the website there. They pretty much want us all to maintain a healthy body weight, which is really for everybody. It's not just for a cancer survivor or someone going through cancer management and treatment. Physical activity, which we've all heard and some of us groan at, that we have to do that every day, 30 minutes roughly. So at least it's not running a marathon. That's one good thing. Eating more vegetables and fruit, limiting alcohol, and food safety. So handling and preparing food safely. And that's something I'll touch on a little bit later, because that's one that often gets a little bit overlooked, is about purchasing and then storing and preparing food as far as health goes. Now let's get cracking into it. So hunger probably is one of the things that people often find a little bit challenging, perhaps when they're going through treatment, the effects of some of the drugs that you've gone through or might still be taking. So is that a common thing that people have found? Yeah. Appetite changes? It either goes through the roof or it's through your boots. You've either got a great appetite and you want to eat everything in sight, or you don't want to touch food. The taste changes as well. Was that experienced by most people? Yeah. All of a sudden, pick up the cup of coffee and it just doesn't taste right. And you've been an addict for years, mm-hmm. and now all of a sudden it doesn't taste good. And that's a very common problem with going through some of the treatments, is that your taste perception and your appetite change, and therefore your oral intake is going to be affected. And you're left with a limited group of foods that you can even tolerate. And then how do we get around that and make you nutritionally sound with this limited intake? And sometimes those taste changes and perception of foods and what you want to eat can last after you've had treatment. So even though all the mouth ulcers or anything like that may have gone and everything's fine again, you still have this inbuilt thing that I can't eat that food. And that's a challenge. So with hunger, we look at what is real physical hunger. And are we actually responding to physical hunger, or are we responding to things like it's 1 o'clock, it's lunchtime? Or emotional hunger? Guilty. Very guilty. Especially if there's a lint ball involved and a bit of a not so great day. So, and environmental hunger, meaning such as say something today where would you normally have eaten biscuits or something like that for morning tea, but you'll have one because they're here. And that's not a bad thing, it's just being aware that that's something that we do. There is a terrific book that I often recommend to people by a man named Rick Krausman. And the book is called If Not Dieting, Then What? As if we are all so programmed to be on a diet And diet is a four-letter word. Now, it's a bad one. But it really just means, what food are you eating? That's all diet is. But his book is about, well, if we're not on a diet, then what happens? If you say to yourself, I don't need to actually be on a diet, what am I going to do? And one of the things that he says in his book is, I can have it, but do I really want it? And that's something that's good to keep in your mind when you're looking at perhaps foods that might be more of the treat foods, is a case of, I can have that, but do I really want it? So we'll go into that a little bit more further down the track. Fullness is another thing that I think sometimes we get a little bit mistaken with too, regarding nutrition and food, and how much are we eating? So you hear a lot about, you know, how do I lose weight, or how do I manage my weight? And a lot of that comes down to, well, what are you eating? And then we go also into, what sort of things are we eating? So we'll touch on that one a little bit further down the track. So we look at the types of food that we're having and the exercise that we're doing. Lean and clean fuel. Does everyone know what I mean by lean and clean? Pretty much low fat and clean food, meaning it hasn't been hampered and touched too much by processing. So if it is as it was meant to be, if it grows, eat it. If it doesn't grow, don't eat it. But if it's a food that has come, you know, and hasn't been interfered with as much as processing goes, that's really what we should be looking at as far as healthiness goes with what we're eating. But also, particularly for someone who's survived cancer, because we just don't want anything unnatural going in there as far as the chemicals and the processing goes. So if we keep it as lean, meaning low fat, and that's for most people. Some people, we do need to crank the fats up a little bit because they might have issues with trying to gain weight and maintain weight. But lean and clean is generally a little catchphrase that I like to use. Regular smaller meals and snacks. Now, who's been guilty of having breakfast and then getting to about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and thinking, I'm feeling a bit hungry, got a headache, feeling a bit vague, realising you haven't eaten anything. Guilty? Yeah, everyone. So keeping everything going, having smaller amounts of food more often is how we're designed to function. And that's something that really is a major change if you can do that, having regular main meals and small snacks. But it comes down to how big are those meals as well. Now remember your little fire. Now I like to say that your metabolism, which is the rate or the speed at which your body uses fuel, your metabolism is like a little fire. So if everyone's been camping at some stage in their life or had to light a fire, small amounts of kindling, often, that's how you get it burning and burning. If you starve a fire, it goes out. And if you walk up and you smother it with a big log, it will also go out. So our bodies are not designed to have big periods of time without food, nor are we designed to have huge, you know, gorging meals where it's just too much in one go. So that's what I mean by remember your metabolism. Small amounts of fuel. And that's not even in regards to weight loss or weight management, it's just always. We can't deal with too much food in one go, and our bodies are not designed that way. We are actually still cave people, or cavemen, women. So our physiology and our anatomy really hasn't changed for thousands and thousands of years. We're the same on the inside. What's changed is what's out there. So Baker's Delight, processed foods, you know, things that we can purchase that are already packaged. And we're not really designed to digest those foods. So if you think of your body still as being quite ancient, and think about what did the ancient people eat, that's what I'm trying to put forward to you, that the more natural the foods are, the better it is, and your body does better with those foods. And being organised and planning your intake. Plastic containers are your friend, or glass if you prefer. But I'm not allowed to say the you know, the ones that start. So taking things with you, being prepared, then you don't have to say to yourself, I have to eat something that's, you know, not perhaps what I really want to do. And it doesn't take that much effort to put something into a container and take it with you. So just being organised can be a really big bonus as far as your health and nourishment goes. One of the things that people often talk to me about, and particularly with some of the more gynecological cancers, is weight gain during treatment or after treatment. And a lot of the time it can be blamed, if you like, on being just so fatigued through your treatment and all of the appointments and sitting there for hours and doing all of that sort of thing, and then just feeling pretty worn out after you've had treatment as well. And that's often a problem then, being not able to keep up with your activity level. Menopausal, being thrown into an early menopause perhaps, or if you've already had the menopause and then you've also got problems on top of that with some of the treatments and those hormonal changes. Am I getting a few people relating to that one?
Yes.
Yes. The cancer treatments sometimes, the steroids, the prednisolone, the dexamethasone, yeah? That's a nasty one for putting weight on, but in two senses. The steroid drugs are great because they help you manage the treatment that you're going through, the chemotherapy or the radiotherapy. But they increase your appetite like no end.
Yes.
Yeah, you've experienced that. And they make you want sugar a lot of the time, carbohydrates, starchy food. All of a sudden you want coffee scrolls and things that you've not previously been, you know, craving for. Or salt. Did anyone have salt cravings with Dexa? Yeah? Hot chips?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, wow, yeah. There we go.
And sauce.
Hot chips and sauce, yeah. Dexa does that to you. So quite often, those drugs, they not only increase your appetite, but they increase your appetite for foods that perhaps aren't as the better choices, maybe. But they do affect your metabolism. So it's not just the food, because it's not the fact that, you know, some people do have Dexa and prednisolone and they're not affected in that way. But they can also make you retain fluids. And so therefore you can be walking around with quite a few extra kilos on you, and it's a lot of it's fluid weight as well. So changes in food intake. I mentioned earlier about taste changes and perception, appetite changes, whereby you think the only thing that I can eat today is, you know, toasted cheese sandwiches, and that might go for 3 days in a row. And then you just think vegetables, fruit, those sorts of things just aren't doing it for you. So that can be a problem too, particularly. You reduce metabolic rate because you're not as active, and also you've been affected by the drugs as well, and retention of fluid. So you've got a few things that are working against us as far as weight management goes, with going through treatment, but then also on the other end. And that's not just, I'm not only focusing on weight gain, because for some people it is the other way. They find it very difficult to maintain weight. They can't put the weight on, they lose it, and then it's really hard because their appetite is gone. So we can talk a little bit about that too. So how do I lose weight? This one irritates me. Don't know if it irritates you as well. Just eat less. We hear that all the time, don't we? Eat less and do more. And that one just, it is to a point. It's true. It's calories in versus calories out. And that's really what does manage our weight. But when you've got a list of other things that are working against you and situations that's really not optimal, then this one can be a little bit challenging. But I do want you to just keep it in mind that it is true, sadly, but we'll be a bit kind to ourselves because of some of the situations that people find themselves in. I particularly like this cartoon. I'm prescribing a low-carbohydrate diet for your diabetes, a high-carb diet for your colon, a low-fat diet for your heart, and a high-fat diet for your nerves. It just looks like, you know, something off a woman's weekly each week, doesn't it? There's a new diet out every 5 minutes which tells us that this is what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing, and it is really hard to follow. What should I be doing? There's so much information out there, and what's right and what's wrong. Now just think about it too for a moment. Upon diagnosis, or even through your journey, I'm sure people wanted to share their stories with you, or share the stories of their cousin or their friend or someone down the track, and this great diet that they did, or this great thing that they tried and it worked. And that then just makes it even more confusing for you, because you've got all this bombardment of information. But what I want you to look at is particularly with priorities, when you're looking at how should I eat, what should I be eating? Does the eating plan that you're looking at following, does it offer a wide variety of food? Or is it limiting? Is there a major food group that's being left out? Or are you being encouraged to not have it at all? That's something that concerns me particularly. Is it a plan that you can live with for a very long time? Can you do this for the rest of your life? Or is it something where it's just do it for 6 weeks? And then I'd be thinking, well, what are we changing there? Why is it only for a short period of time? Do you still enjoy eating? If you have to follow this plan, is food still okay and fun and interesting and enjoyable? Or is it becoming a bit of a chore? Make sure that there are fruits and vegetables and cereals and low-fat foods in that diet. If those things are being omitted, then that's a real concern. And looking at weight management, I'd look at 0.5 kilo a week, really. Maybe 1 kilo if you were really, really gunning it. But 0.5 kilo is pretty much, you've got to think, 0.5 kilo of fat loss is a big tub of margarine. That's pretty big. Mm. You know when you stand on the scales and you think, I've only lost 400 grams, I've only lost 0.5 kilo. That's that big margarine container full of pure fat. That's what I want you to think about. So don't be discouraged by the fact that if you have stood on the scales, if you've been trying to lose weight, that you think, oh, it's only a few hundred grams, okay? All right, so we're just touching again on metabolism. It is the rate at which your body uses up energy. Remember the little fire, small amounts often. And I just want to mention starvation mode, because I mentioned to you before about going long periods of time without food. Our bodies are designed, as I said before, as caveman, cavewoman, we're designed to avoid exactly that starvation mode. When you go long periods of time without food, your body starts to shut down a little bit and it says, right, I'm going to hold on to absolutely everything that you give me now. So it says, she's been starving me for 8 hours, 9 hours maybe, and this has been a bit of a pattern. I'm going to hold everything that she gives me. And then what does your body do with fuel that it holds on to? It stores it. Stores it away for later, just in case you do it again. So please stop with the, if anyone's guilty, long periods of time without food is not a good way to go. We need small amounts often to keep fueling so that we avoid that starvation mode. Does everyone remember the old pyramid that used to, the food pyramid that used to be on the back of cereal packets and etc.? And a lot of them at the time, it's still there. The Dietitians Association and the National Dietary Guidelines people got together and they've changed it now. So now we've got this lovely plate. And it's the same thing, it's just represented as a plate instead. Now you haven't got a picture of it in your notes because it didn't show up well when we printed it. But you can find this one on the website that I've given at the end of the talk. So pretty much it's the same as the pyramid. The reason they got rid of the pyramid was because people always thought that the things at the top were the best, you know, the fairy on the Christmas tree, and yet that was where all the fat and the sugar and the junk was. So it was being misunderstood. So they've put it down now mostly as a plate. So saying that really a good variety of grains and cereals, fruits and veggies, dairy, bit of meat, and you might even see that the treats way off down in the right hand corner, they're not even considered part of the daily plate intake. Okay, carbohydrates, the starchy foods, their role is pretty much to put glucose or sugar into your bloodstream. That's your main source of fuel. That's the fuel that your brain works on and the fuel that most of the body works on. If you've got extra, once you've filled up your blood glucose levels or your blood sugar levels, your body will store it as something called glycogen, and that gets stored in the muscles and in the liver. So that if you do have a period of time where you're not taking in any carbohydrate and you need some blood, some sugar in your blood, the body will then draw from those stores to top up the blood. So it's a little bit of robbing Peter to pay Paul, and that's how it keeps it balanced. The role of the carbohydrates is to keep your metabolism going, your central nervous system, so all of your brain functions. It means that you're using it as your primary source of fuel and you're sparing protein. Protein is in muscle mass, pretty much. So if we've got carbohydrate in your system, you're using that as fuel and you're not breaking down your muscle mass. And we've got some good dietary sources there of carbohydrates. Usual things, bread, pastas, rice, fruit, veggies, dairy foods and legumes, etc. Good old starchy foods. Now, we used to talk about carbohydrates as being simple versus complex. Does that sound familiar to some people? Yeah. And that's slightly outdated now. We tend to talk about the glycemic index, another new catchphrase. Again, is that familiar to some people? Yeah. So the glycemic index is simply a ranking system of how quickly does your body use that carbohydrate and how quickly does it turn into glucose or sugar and go into your bloodstream. So I'll use the example of something like white bread versus a really grainy, gutsy, grainy bread. So the white bread would be digested and broken down to glucose quite quickly in the digestive system, released into your blood system as sugar, probably around 20 minutes. Whereas a really nice, thick, gutsy, you know, grainy bread, that could take up to an hour. So we tend to look then is it a high glycemic index food or is it low glycemic index food? And a good way to remember it is slow. Low GI means slow release. It's a bit of a trickle of sugar or glucose into your system. A bit like putting your thumb over the hose and letting it trickle down as opposed to a big spurt. Now, is anyone going to do a little activity and be a volunteer? You are required to eat a lolly. Anyone brave?
Yeah.
Yeah, come on. I'm going to show you just a very quick demonstration on how quickly our bodies respond to nutrition, particularly sugar. Very exciting. Do you know what? The good thing is I'm going to hand these around so you all get one as well. Not just those special. All right, come over here. Right, over there. Will that still be able to hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. What I'm going to do with...
Ultra.
Ultra, easy. All right. I'm going to ask you to put your arms out. And all I'm going to do is push down, you know, not too hard, on her arms, and she's going to push up against me. Ready, set. Oh, she's quite strong. Wow. Okay, maybe I should have picked someone up. Now, what I want you to do afterwards, have a lolly and chew it up and let it go all around your mouth so there's lots of absorption. We actually start to absorb carbohydrate and glucose first thing in our... This is the beginning of our digestive system. Often we think it's all happening down here, but in fact it's all starting here. So the more you can push it around, lots of saliva, getting it all sucking in. Is that feeling pretty nice? They're good, aren't they? Yeah. My favourite thing. What do you reckon? Have you swallowed it? It's gone. Arms out. I'm going to do this again. Now, in your head, I want you to think what's probably going to happen to her. Ready, set, go.
Oh.
You're pushing harder.
Yes, I don't. All right, I'm going to let you stay there for 30 seconds, maybe. So it seems that it was harder.
Mm-hmm.
I swear I was pushing exactly the same. All right, let's try again. Now. Oh, good. You're back to normal. Maybe even a little stronger. Okay.
Take another one.
Take another one.
I'll have the whole packet.
You can pass them around. If anyone would like one, I'll pass them around. Not many dietitians will let you eat chocolate lollies. Now, what that demonstrates, and thank you very much, what that demonstrates is at first you would think, I've given her fuel. I've given her pure fuel. It's just sugar, glucose. But what happens is as the body digests that sugar, she was there with her normal blood sugar level circulating in her body. She's ready to do some activity. That's not a problem. She has the sugar. And what happens? We eat sugar. There's another hormone involved called insulin. So when the sugar level comes into the body, the insulin matches it and carries the glucose from the digestive system out into the blood. When that sugar rise is really quick, which it would be with almost pure sugar, sugar goes up, the insulin goes up, and sometimes the insulin overshoots it and brings your blood sugar level down lower than where you started, just for a few moments. That was the reason you felt that it was, you were a bit weaker for that time, and then a few moments later it was all balanced again. So for someone without diabetes, I must point out, that's all going to work well. If you've got diabetes, that's not going to work as well. But what that indicates is that that's how quickly nutrition affects our bodies. And sugar particularly, blood sugar levels, not so much just eating sweets. But if you're going long periods of time, as I said before, without fuel, or you've got very high glycemic index sugars and carbohydrates, the things that release their sugars very quickly, you're going to have a roller coaster of a day, up and down with the blood sugars. And what happens is when those levels go down, we start to feel a bit tired, a bit listless, think, ooh, wouldn't mind a lolly, wouldn't mind a bicky, something to perk you up again. And then you go and have that thing, and we get this again, and half an hour later we're down again. So every couple of hours you're looking for something to perk you up. Whereas if we can put the low glycemic index carbohydrates in, then you're going to get a nice, even, balanced little roll of sugar going into the bloodstream through the day. It's not going to be as dramatic. And then you don't go searching for the things that we shouldn't perhaps be having as much of, but you're going to feel better because you've constantly got this nice trickle of energy into the system. The other thing is that the lower glycemic index carbohydrates tend to be the ones that are better for us anyway. They're higher in grains, higher in fibre, they tend to be less processed. So that's something I just want you to keep in mind. You might need to go and do a bit more research on glycemic index because it is a bit more complex than just that little demonstration, but it gives you a good idea of seeing how quickly sugar can get into your bloodstream. Now, I'm not saying sugar's bad, I'm just saying just be aware of how quickly or slowly those carbohydrates can go into the bloodstream. Now, the things that affect the GI is the type of carbohydrate. So as I said before, whether it's very grainy or not processed or has been processed. The cooking methods that you've used. So if you were to say, eat an apple, and then that's pretty low GI. If you were to cook it, you're bringing it up to a moderate GI because by cooking an apple or baking it, you've pretty much partially digested it almost. It's pretty easy then for your body to digest. And then if you were to just drink the juice of the apple, that's going to be a little bit more to the moderate to high level because it's quite a concentrated version of the sugar. Your body didn't have to do much to break it down. And fibre affects the GI, so the higher the fibre, the lower the GI, and fat as well. So that's the one thing that can catch a few people out, is that when they say something like a Mars bar might be low GI, you think, hang on, that's got a whack of sugar in it, but it's also got quite a whack of fat in there. So the fat lowers the GI because it slows digestion. I don't want to fill you up with too much information, but just be aware. All right, so high GI foods are things like honey, cornflakes, baked white potato, wholemeal breads, even white and wholemeal breads, soft drinks, lollies, that sort of thing, sports drinks. Moderate GI is sugar. So don't fear having a sugar in your cup of tea. It's not that bad. But just be aware of how many times you're doing that in a day. White rice, that is, soft drinks, fruit juices, things like Weet-Bix even. Low GI are the things that are, as I said before, less processed. So porridge, multigrain bread, pastas, beans, legumes, fruit, milk, those sorts of things. And when you look at it, they're probably the things we should be eating anyway. They're the better choices. Because it's still pretty processed. It's because some of the white breads that have high fibre, you know, they advertise them as white high fibre, they've actually got a lower GI because they've added fibre to them than some of the wholemeal breads. So preferably a grainy bread is going to be the one that's better for you. Rice is an interesting one. Certain rices have different gratings in GI. So the ones that we say are the lower GI rices are basmati and dungara. Dungara is an Australian grown rice. The long grain rices, it has to do with the starch and how tightly knit those starch particles are. and therefore how much work does it take to digest, to break them down and release the sugars. So the Dungara and Basmati have a sort of tighter knit, if you like, form of starch, whereas the white rices, they're a little bit looser, so it doesn't take as much for the body to break it down and release the glucose into the system. Yeah.
Those
who
use
fresh
pastas, low GI?
Yep, fresh pasta's even the better one. Better again.
Better than brown, than
dried out stuff.
No, the whole, sorry, I've lost the word. The whole meal pasta?
About the same. Oh. Yeah, about the same. But as I said, it's a great website that if you, in fact, use a search engine of choice and search GI, there is a website for, and they've got everything listed on there that you can have a good look at. So looking at the dietary guidelines, the breads and cereals, we really want you to choose whole grain ones. And this is just really from a health point of view. Different types of breads and cereals, you can mix it around a little bit. Two to four serves a day. Now the dietary guidelines used to say up to 11 serves a day, which we all used to jump up and down and say that's ridiculous unless you're about 16 years old and male and playing football 10 times a week. Especially when you look at one serve of carbohydrate or of the breads and cereals is the equivalent of two slices of bread. So technically that's eight slices of bread. So really this needs to be interpreted as to what are your energy needs, how much activity are you doing in the day, and what do you actually, that's where you might sit down with a dietitian and work out what am I doing and what do I really need. A good source of insoluble fibre. Now, the two types of fibre, soluble, insoluble. Soluble is the one that we can digest and your body uses, and that helps with bowel health. The insoluble is what we used to call roughage. That's pretty much the stuff that comes out. So we don't use it so much, but most of the breads and cereals that we have these days have been processed in a way that it's a good form of insoluble fibre. So just keep a little look there at the serving sizes. So a half to one cup of breakfast cereal is a serve. Now, as a little exercise, when you go home, measure it out. How much is half a cup of cereal? It's really not that much. And when you think about what we do in the morning, perhaps pouring out our cereals, just it's a good indicator of serving sizes as to what you're doing and how much you're having. And again, half to one cup of cooked rice or noodles or pasta is one serve. And again, I know that's a pretty meagre serve when you look at it, when you think about what we would normally put on a plate, perhaps. So the dietary guidelines again, eating more vegetables and fruit. Five serves of vegetables a day, two serves of fruit. A variety is really important. And when I teach children, and I'm actually using it a lot more now with adults as well, but I say, eat a rainbow every day. So there's no one wonder vegetable. There's no magic, you know, king of the crop. We need to have a variety of vegetables to get all the different minerals and vitamins from all those different colours. The different colours have different levels of vitamins and minerals in them. Likewise, I don't want you to just be eating, you know, the same three vegetables every day, because then you're missing out on all the other things, but you're also getting a bit, you know, just always the same thing. All right, so a rainbow, lots of different colours, lots of different varieties is really important. And it's not that hard to fit them in, especially when you think that it's only half a cup is one serve. So I don't need you to be eating two, you know, big buckets of vegetables or anything, but you do need to look at the variety. Now, protein is probably one of my little favourite things, especially for people who have gone through cancer, recovering, going through treatment, and out the other end, anywhere in between. A lot of the therapies that we have to go through for treating cancers tend to, obviously, kill off the nasty cells, but they tend to kill off a lot of healthy cells as well. And it's mostly the cells that line the gut that are affected by chemotherapy and radiotherapy. So that the gut starts in your mouth. So that's why perhaps mouth ulcers, taste changes, all of those things are happening, but the lining of your mouth is being affected by the chemotherapy, all the way through your digestive system, right down to the bowel. And those cells are being killed off at a quicker rate than what they would normally just be sloughed away. So we need protein, it's the building blocks of new cells. We need to have the protein coming in through your diet so that your body can generate and build new cells back again. Otherwise, what happens? We start to break down our muscle mass to try and provide the protein to the body to grow new cells to recover. And that's where frailness comes in, which is a dirty word, frailness. We don't like frail. Right? We want strong, healthy women, not women who are losing muscle mass. So that's why I want you to really focus on protein. The role in the body is pretty much for body structures. So muscles, hormones, your immune system really requires quite a bit of protein. And your gut is very much involved in your immune system. So if the gut and the lining of the gut is at all compromised, it brings your immune system down. You become more susceptible to bugs and illnesses. And it's just needed for general health as well. So dietary sources tend to be the animal products. So meat, fish, chicken, eggs, dairy products, soy, and some of the protein alternatives now that are around, which mostly tend to be plant-based. So I think one of the more popular ones at the moment now is something that's called corn, but it's spelled Q-U-O-R-N. Has anyone seen that or used it? Yeah, interesting flavour.
I think it's processed.
It is. Again, it's a processed food. So if you can stick with the more natural, then that's probably a better way to go.
What's nuts?
Nuts is a really good one. Mostly, they're fat. So the predominant composition of nuts is fat. But they do have a bit of protein and they do have a lot of fibre. So they're actually a very good snack in small amounts. So we don't want to be sitting and eating too many. But as a source of protein, especially if you were to be adding nuts into something like a cereal mix or a trail mix that you have a small handful of with some dried fruits and things like that during the day, they're a good little snack. Usually it's around 30 grams, which if you think about filling up a matchbox with almonds or hazelnuts or some such, that's about 30 grams. Just to give you a little visual idea of it. It's not a lot, unfortunately. A lot less than what we would like to maybe have each day, but it gives you a little bit of an idea.
Isn't that Q-U-I-N? Is that related or the same as quinoa?
No, different. Yeah, so quinoa is a different grain. It does have an amount of protein in it, but the quinoa is another ancient grain that's become quite popular too because it's gluten-free. Yeah, fine. Again, interesting flavour, so it might be something you enjoy, it might be something you
choose
not to
have. You can make yummy salads.
Yeah, it's a bit like, similar to couscous, and different things.
But it hasn't got the carbohydrate.
Not as high a carbohydrate level, that's right, and it is generally a low GI. All right. Milk and yogurt and cheese. Do you remember the old ad that used to be on telly? Piece of cheese, a glass of milk, that one tub of yogurt. Well, that's pretty much right. So we're looking at 3 serves a day. The main thing that we get from our dairy food is calcium and, in some cases, too, vitamin D. So calcium is really important. A lot of the drugs that perhaps we would have gone on, the steroid drugs, they tend to leach calcium from your bones. And a lot of some of the pain medication as well can be leaching of calcium. So we really do need to stock it up. Now, a lot of the time people think, is it too late? Am I, too old to be topping ourselves up? There's never a limit, all right? So I want you to think of it like a little bank account and keep putting that calcium in each day, preferably with real food. But sometimes, depending on what treatments you've gone through, you might need to be taking a supplement. So that's something to talk with your doctor and possibly if you've got a dietitian as well, that's really important to do. But I'm just saying, real food first, but sometimes we do need to take a supplement to go with it. Similarly with vitamin D. Now, I'm guilty, I had low vitamin D, I'm sure. Yeah, there's quite a few nodding heads, yeah. And again, that's a treatment thing as well. Sometimes too, we can blame it on the fact that we've been so diligent with our flip-flop-flap. Mm-hmm. We've been very, very careful and I've walked in today wearing my hat and being very cautious of the sun. So in some ways, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. But we do need to be aware of it. Low vitamin D levels and low calcium levels can really affect your bone health, and especially after treatment, you're just already a little bit behind the eight ball. So I want you to be careful there.
So what happens if, like, I'm lactose intolerant? So
yeah. So what about a lactose-free milk?
Oh, no.
No?
Don't just like the them? Word milk is enough, too.
Oh, okay. You've not tried lactose-free?
I have not.
Okay.
Just
because it doesn't, yeah. Okay.
A dirty word.
So there are, with a lot of the soy milk options, they fortify those with extra calcium and vitamin D. They're quite adequate, not a problem. If you're looking at things like almond milk, rice milk, those sorts of things, the calcium level's usually not there because they're not as popular and mainstream. They haven't supplemented them as much. So then I'd be looking at other options for vitamin D, which might come from some of the oily fishes and fats and things, which would be something you could research a little more. And then again, we'd look at supplementation down the track.
Okay.
All right, meat, chicken, fish, the usual. These are our sources of protein. So if it is an animal or if it came from an animal, it's going to be high in protein generally. 1 to 2 serves a day. Now, a serve of meat is about the size of a deck of cards, and that's around about 100 grams. So the palm of your hand, perhaps, or think of the deck of cards, that's about the serving size that we need. And cooked fish, again, it might be a little bit bigger. Remember that when you cook fish, it loses a lot of water. So what you buy is not really what you get to eat at the end. So just think, buy bigger, and then by the time it's cooked, because it does have a high water content. Red meat, we like it to be up to 3 or 4 times a week. That's not always achievable, but if you can aim for it, then you might at least get 2 or 3 meals in of red meat. Fish, 2 to 3 times a week, and I prefer the deep sea fish. Reason being is that they're higher in the omega-3 oils. Because they live in colder water, they've got more of a fat content in their own flesh, so you're getting more bang for your buck, pretty much. You're getting the omega-3s in there as well. There doesn't appear to be a strong association between red meat and cancer risk. Now, around about the 80s, I think it was, there was a campaign, red meat causes cancer. And when that was looked into and pulled apart a little bit by a lot of the dietitians looking at it at the time, it was a very clever campaign because it stopped people from eating red meat. But in fact, and it was mostly in regards to bowel cancer. Now, the problem with that was, in fact, the red meat was not the culprit. But a diet that's very high in red meat is often not inclusive of the fruits and the vegetables and the grains. So there's a big piece of meat on the plate and maybe a bit of a cooked potato or something and not much else. So in fact, the causational relationship was more that the diet was low in fibre, had a higher causal risk to bowel cancer than eating the red meat alone. So being careful of some of the messages that you might hear about certain foods and certain nutrients, don't just take them on face value. You really need to think, all right, who provided the information? Where did the research come from? That sort of thing. And really have a good think about what might the real message be in there.
What about the red meat versus cholesterol 3 to 4 times?
Lean meat, I should say, in there. So the main part, or the problem with cholesterol relationship, is saturated or animal fat. So lean meat, the muscle part, if you can see the fat, you cut it off. Or the skin on the chicken, you take that off. I know, I'm sorry, it's the nicest bit for some people, but as far as cholesterol goes, that's what we need to do. The benefits of the meat and the meat protein is very important to us. But if you can cut the meat fat off and not cook with it, then that's going to counteract the risk then of cholesterol as well.
Can I miss something then? The fish on the deep sea fish, that was salmon. You're saying remove that if you have
time. Oh, no. Skin of chicken. Take that off. Yeah, no, leave the skin of fish, that's fine. No, that doesn't have anywhere of a problem with cholesterol. No, that's fine, you can eat that bit. And that's usually the really nice crispy bit on the outside anyway. That's the bit we want. So limiting the processed meats, the sausages and the frankfurts and all of those things that you might be a bit suspicious about what's actually ended up in the sausage at the end. those are the things we want to get rid of out of the diet, or have them only occasionally. They're usually high fat and high salt, and really, as far as nourishment goes, they're not that great. I'm just cautious of time, so I want to keep moving along a little. The role of fat is really important in our bodies, and I don't want anyone to think that we can't have fat. You know, fat's often also a bad word, that we think, oh no, we must have none at all. We need it very much for a lot of the production of our cells and our hormones and various functions in the body. But we do want to not have a storage of excess fat in the system. Now, there's three types of fat. There's the saturated, monounsaturated, polyunsaturated. Now, they can be split into two groups. Saturated comes from animals, and mono and polys come from plants. And for the most part, we want to focus on the monos and the polys. They're the vegetable oils and vegetable fats. And they tend to be what we call the good fats. So you see the good and the bad. The animal fats tend to be the ones that we want to try and avoid. So fats, well, we all know where they are. They're pretty much in the obvious things like butters and oils and margarines, but they can be hidden. So what I want you to start also thinking about, and I'm sure you guys do already, is reading labels and having a look at what things appear as. They don't always just say fat. They'll say all sorts of other names for it along the way. So just being a little bit of a sleuth as far as reading labels go. And that goes also on label reading for things like salt and sugar. There's about 20 different ways of saying sugar. You know, monosaccharides, disaccharides, you know, syrups, invert syrups, rice syrups, this sort of thing. It's all sugar. So you need to be quite careful. When, a little bit off track here, but with labelling, most ingredients are listed from most to least. So if you read that it's got, you know, flour, eggs, they're the things that are in most abundance. And then down toward the end might be the flavours and colourings and, you know, spices and things like that. If sugar, fat, are in the very first two or three, then you know that that's the most abundant ingredient in that food. Now, to get around some of the labelling laws where they say you can only have a percentage of sugar in something, depending on how it's been labelled, then they might say, well, yes, here's our cane sugar component, but there's also a rice syrup that's been added, or an invert syrup or something rather else that's been added, so that really there's still a hell of a lot of sugar in there, but it's just been labelled in a tricky way so they get around it. So just being careful, reading labels is really good. The fewer numbers the better, is as far as I'm concerned. When you're reading a label, if you can see real foods in something, that's great. But if there's lots of things in brackets and numbers and funny names, we might try to get away from those.
Is there a recommended percentage with fat, with saturated fat, that you should aim to
be? Yeah. The Heart Foundation have got some really good guidelines. So if you get a chance to get onto their website, that's a really good one. But generally we say for a low-fat diet, it's around 30 grams a day of fat.
When you're looking at a tub of yogurt,
yep,
that gives you a percentage per 100 grams.
Yep.
What percentage should you look at?
I generally look, and if you're looking on labels at 100 grams, because when you look at labels, for example, cereal, if you pick up two cereal boxes, the serving size might be 45 grams on one, it might be 60 grams on the other. It's too hard to calculate then, so always go to the 100 grams column, and then looking for a food that's under 10% fat, generally. Yep, that's going to be an overall health, you know, message. If you have specific dietary needs, it might be lower than that, but I'd be encouraging. Just depends. All right, so let's just whiz through here. Fats and oils, we use them sparingly in cooking. Low-fat methods of cooking are great. Trimming the fat, as I said before, from the food that you're having. Just limiting margarine and butter. Looking at alternatives, using a bit of low-fat dip or some chutney or anything else really, just to put some moisture into your sandwich. It doesn't have to be margarine and butter. It could be any other number of relishes or things like that. It really is, that's all butter really does in a sandwich, is just to hold everything together and stick it down and give it a bit of moisture. So if you can think of something that's a little bit less fatty to put in, that's another alternative. Try to limit the amount of high fat snacks and takeaways and processed foods, fried foods, and using the plant oils mainly as well. There are two oils that are plant-based which is coconut and palm oil, and they do behave in the body like a saturated fat, so your body can in fact build cholesterol from those. So we do again say it's good to try and limit the intake of palm and coconut oils in your diet.
The local health food man says, told me that coconut oil doesn't change with heat, where some of the other, so if you use a little bit, it's better to use a little bit, because some of the other oils, their composition alters with heat, so.
Yeah, and look, different oils have different heat points at which they start to denature or fall apart and become rancid. One of the common ones is flaxseed oil, which is a really good omega-3, and I think I go into that a little bit further down the track. But that's an oil that can't be heated at all, or else it will denature, so it's got to be kept at room temperature.
So
but yes, you do need to be careful.
So
about
what oil do you choose for cooking, for example?
For me, olive oil is cooking. My preference, olive oil. Yeah.
Excuse me, how is the rice oil?
Rice oil is fine too. I just don't know much about the heating point of it, but as far as I know, it can be used in cooking. It has got a significant flavour, so it can affect more the flavours of foods than, say, good old olive oil. Similarly with things like peanut oil or sesame oil, just that remembering they've got a flavour to them already, so they can affect foods. But being a plant-based oil, they're generally quite fine. Okay. Now, extra foods, of course, these are the ones that we all love, but they're the ones that we want to try and limit. So treats, basically, one or two times a week, and limiting the processed foods. It's all common sense. You guys, you know this stuff already. Now, water is something that we really harp on about. Mostly, we're made of about 90% water, believe it or not. And thirst is really not a good indicator of dehydration. By the time you feel thirsty, you're pretty much already on your way to being a bit dehydrated. See a few people having a good old cup of water there. That was a good cue. Yeah. So what I want you to do is just hold your hand up in front of you and pinch the skin on the back of your hand. Pull it up a little bit so you make like a little triangle and then let it go. And just see how quickly did it bounce back or did it kind of hover around for a bit. We got a few hoverers.
Yeah.
A bit dry, maybe. Now, bearing in mind that your collagen and your elastin tend to go a little bit as we get a bit older, so I'll be very careful how I say that. But it's not a bad indicator. So as the better hydration you have, that skin should pop back fairly quickly. If it's really hanging around and kind of taking its time to go back down, it's a bit of an indicator. But by the time you're thirsty, you're already a bit dehydrated. And water, again, similarly to food, we need small amounts often. Guzzling a whole heap of water is sort of like the old saying, putting the cart before the horse. You need to be just taking a good intake of fluids through the day. Now, you might find, and I'm sure this has affected some people with treatment, that water tasted funny, metallic even, or a bit tinny, And people then often would say to me, I don't really want to put sugary cordial into it because that's not good for me either. There has to be a point of compromise. So a little bit of cordial isn't a bad thing if that's what you need to get that fluid in, because really, I'd rather you had a little bit of sugar and were well hydrated than didn't have the fluid because you didn't want to add something to make the taste a bit better. One thing that I've noticed with a few people telling me is that tonic water is very, very well tolerated if you've got that metallic funny taste in your mouth from treatment.
It's good for the ulcers too.
Yeah. Yep. And that was the other thing too, that some of the other drinks would sting if you had ulcers in the mouth or any sort of mucositis. So the tonic water is well tolerated. So just a trick to keep up your sleeve. So generally we look at 6 to 8 cups a day, being 250 mils being a cup, so we're looking at ideally 2 litres of fluid in a day. Who thinks they'd get 2 litres in?
Is that on top of the fluid that's in food?
Ah, no, that's just it, 2 litres. It's hard, it really is hard to get that much fluid in, but my theory is if you aim for it, you might even get 80%, and that's a really good way of doing it. coffee doesn't count, right? Because of the caffeine. I know, I'm sorry. Oh, you should see the faces of despair. But because coffee has the caffeine, which is a natural diuretic, so then what happens? You drink one cup of coffee, you'll wee out that cup and another, again, of fluid. So it draws extra fluid with it. So coffee doesn't count. But generally, you know, herbal teas are okay. Tea's okay, but it still does have a wee bit of caffeine in there. But really, just think about keeping a bottle with you all the time, having a glass of water, you know, before lunch or at morning tea, afternoon tea, just that sort of thing along the way. If you commute somewhere, it's easy to drink a small bottle on the way and one again on the way home, and then you've sort of knocked off maybe, you know, 800 mils to a litre in getting there and back. So that's not a bad way either. But we start to feel really ordinary if we get dehydrated. Headache, tired, listless, a bit forgetful, more forgetful than normal. So all those things, achy joints and that sort of thing. So if you're thinking to yourself that you're starting to feel a bit ordinary, then also start to think, when have I drunk well? And did I drink well yesterday? Sometimes there's a bit of a lag time with hydration as well. So you really need to be constantly vigilant about putting that fluid in. It helps with flushing through the medications that you might be on, or any treatments as well, or any subsequent medications that you might be taking. So really help your body by giving it fluid. Most of us can go, you know, if you're having a not so well time, a day or two without eating optimally, that's tolerable. But a day or two without fluids, we're in strife, big strife. So really be vigilant with your water. It's one thing I get on my high horse about. All right, speaking of fluids, alcohol. All right. The Cancer Council recommendations are to limit or avoid alcohol. Not always realistic, but now the standards, or the alcohol recommendations, for men they say no more than 2 standard drinks a day, and for women it's down to 1 standard drink a day. You know, when you go to a hotel or a pub and they pour you a glass of wine and you think, oh, is that all? That's a standard measure, whereas the glass that you might pour yourself at home is a little bit more generous. So we're talking about standard measures, right? And we avoid the binge drinking. Having a few alcohol-free days is part of the recommendation each week. And this is just an example there of what a standard drink is. So a small amount, really. With treatment, often people ask me, can I drink while I'm having chemo? Or can I drink while having radiotherapy? There's no interaction. You can. You can have a glass of wine. You can have a glass of spirits. That's fine. It just might not taste good.
Yeah, you don't feel
it. So again, yep, that funny taste perception thing that happens. You pick up the glass of wine and all of a sudden, oh, that just is awful. It tastes like vinegar or something horrible. So again, it comes down to, if it tastes all right, it's okay to have in moderation as part of the guidelines. If it doesn't taste good, that's fine. Give it a miss for a while. All right, let's get on to physical activity. We all know it's good for us and what it does, so boosting your metabolism and your energy levels. Decreasing fatigue. Now, this sounds like a bit of a oxymoron, really, doesn't it? I'm really tired. I should go and go for a walk. But it's true. Going out, using your muscles, it starts to wake everything up. It gets your blood going. The other thing is it gets your head out of the space it was in 10 minutes ago when you were feeling really tired and awful. It doesn't mean running a marathon. It means go just for a walk. Walk down and get the paper and walk back, or just walk around the block. You don't need to set yourself a big, you know, before diagnosis I used to be able to walk, you know, an hour twice a day or something like that. That was then, this is now, and this is I'm going out for a walk for 10 minutes. And if you go for 10 minutes and you think, right, I'm going to keep going for another half hour, great, do that. But it is definitely going to help with fatigue levels. The more active you can be, and small amounts often again, you can do 2 small walks in a day, that's not a problem. That's going to help with fatigue, particularly. It's going to decrease any health risks as well, because you're maintaining your cardiovascular fitness, which can be knocked around quite a bit by treatment. Maintaining the muscle mass, remember I was harping on about that earlier, so keeping those muscles good and strong means that you're going to keep your body physically well and able to get to go through things like having to embark on treatment and getting out the other end. good for lowering stress and anxiety as well. So guidelines are about 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, and preferably start slowly. So don't go, as my dad would say, like a bull at a gate. Just go slowly. And talk to the doctor about it, talk to your oncologist about it, talk to any health practitioner that's helping you out at the moment, but small amounts.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan Podcasts or browse existing podcasts by visiting www.brecan.org.au.